I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Lost in the back and forth about what President Trump said to the widow of Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, who was killed in Niger earlier this month, is what was Johnson and the three other U.S. Special Forces soldiers who were also killed doing in that part of Africa. We're learning more about the details of the attack, but many were in the dark about the mission until last week. Here's Senator John McCain on The View yesterday. He chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Americans should know what's going on in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Should know what caused the deaths of four brave young Americans. Mm-hmm. Should know what kind of operations we're engaged in. And one of the fights I'm having right now with the administration is that Armed Services Committee is not getting enough information.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserve it because we represent their families, too.
We asked Richard Downey to join us. He's deputy director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Before that, he worked as a journalist, including at the BBC, and he joins us from Skype. Richard Downey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Joseph Dunford, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, held a press conference yesterday to talk about at least what they're willing to share with us about what happened in Niger just about a month ago, or certainly 3 weeks ago. Did we learn anything new?
Not really. The most striking thing from that press conference was how just the very basic details of what was going on this tragic mission on October 4th. We still don't know. Joseph Dunford said that these four soldiers were on a routine reconnaissance patrol, that they were working alongside troops from Niger when they came under attack. But a lot of the basic information remains very unclear.
And American troops have been in this part of the world and in this country for some time now. Do we know how long?
Yeah, well, U.S. troops have been entered a more active phase on the African continent in the last decade, and that was since the stand-up of the U.S. Africa Command, a sort of geographic combatant command that was set up 10 years ago now to cover the whole of Africa. And Niger is has become a focus of operations, mainly training and trying to professionalize the security forces in that country. And we're told that there are now about 800 U.S. troops operating in Niger, which I have to say was quite a high number. It took me by surprise.
That surprised you, even though you're deputy director of the CSIS Africa program?
Maybe a gap in my knowledge, but certainly, you know, they're performing a variety of roles there. You know, this is a tough neighborhood. There are a lot of active Islamist terrorist groups and militia in the region. But U.S. troops are being deployed there in a training capacity. But also in basic things like securing and protecting U.S. At the U.S. Embassy and other buildings. Also building right now a drone base, a second drone base actually for the U.S. in Niger so that they can conduct better surveillance of the whole region.
And who's the target or who's the enemy, if that's the correct word?
So it's a sort of grab bag of different groups. Al-Qaeda has and its affiliates have been active in the region for more than a decade, originally sort of from their home in Algeria. But the problem has sort of moved southwards and Niger is immediately south of Algeria. Really, these groups take refuge in places where there are loose controls and weak security forces and perhaps the reach of the government is fairly weak. Well, Niger and its neighboring countries in the Sahel, the sort of band of countries immediately south of the Sahara, fit that bill. So AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, has been active there. And also Islamic State now is trying to establish a presence in some of these countries.
And we're talking about the use of special forces in this part of Africa and I guess in other volatile parts of that continent. Why special forces?
Well, special forces can get into places that regular troops are less able to do so. They are specialists in some of the kinds of training events that are being conducted with African counterpart militaries right now. They do these things called joint combined exchange trainings. And so they are sort of out there and active and involved at sort of the hard end of the fight against these terrorist groups.
Is there any way to know whether we're winning or not? I mean, clearly four Americans were killed in early October, but broadly speaking, are we making progress in that part of the world?
The short answer is no. You know, it's when AFRICOM was first stood up 10 years ago, there was one recognized terrorist group in this region. There are now a proliferation of them, perhaps 20 plus. But the central mission of AFRICOM in Africa is to train and equip and professionalize African militaries so that one day they can these countries can take charge of their own security problems. We've seen little flickers of progress in some parts of the continent. For example, in the Gambia, right on the corner of West Africa earlier this year, a combined force of militaries from neighboring states helped to remove the president there, who had illegally stayed in office. So there are you know, little signs that African militaries themselves are starting to take the lead, but certainly those are probably exceptions rather than to the rule.
I'm actually thinking of East Africa, and President Obama sent in special forces to try to find Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army leader. This was in Uganda. Have they found him? Do we know anything about what that mission is about?
No, Joseph Kony remains at large, the head of the Lord's Resistance Army. This is a particularly violent, brutal insurgency group that's been active initially in Uganda, as you say, but has now spread to neighboring countries in the Great Lakes region. The U.S. Launched a mission to support local military forces in their effort to eradicate the LRA. They've succeeded in reducing the numbers of active combatants in the LRA. They're thought to be fewer than 200 now, but they failed to get the main man, Joseph Kony, who remains at large.
Why is this so difficult?
Well, I think it's partly the terrain is incredibly difficult. This is a very, very hardened small group that is very nimble, knows the terrain very, very well. But I think the chief difficulty is that, you know, these missions can only succeed if African militaries themselves are willing to take the lead. And in the case of the counter LRA mission, the countries that are involved in the mission just aren't sufficiently invested in it. And that's why the whole thing has sort of fallen apart.
Let me play something that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, said yesterday. This was at a press conference talking about what happened in Niger.
In our judgment, we're dealing with global threats in Al-Qaeda, in ISIS, and other groups. And the theory of the case of our strategy is to be able to put pressure on them simultaneously wherever they are. And as importantly, to anticipate where they will be and to make sure that where they are and where they will be when they get there, they're confronted by local security forces that have the ability to meet the challenges associated with Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other groups. And so we are working with partners on the ground in West Africa. We are working with partners on the ground in other parts of Africa. It's the same thing we're doing in Iraq and Syria, and it's what we're doing in Afghanistan.
I'm thinking about Senator John McCain basically saying I and other members of the U.S. Congress have been unaware, I guess, about the level of involvement in dealing with the threats of terrorist organizations. Is that surprising? Does that surprise or even shock you?
Yeah, it's quite surprising as someone who studies Africa and has seen this is not a new phenomenon. You know, AFRICOM has been around for has been around for a decade now, and you've seen a steady increase in the U.S. troop presence in the African continent throughout that decade, up to about sort of 6,000 U.S. personnel in the African continent at any one time or other. So, okay, when you compare that with Iraq, Afghanistan, that's a very small number spread very thinly across a huge continent. But nonetheless, it's a significant investment. And it's when you look at other arms of the U.S. government, which are being depleted in terms of diplomatic assets and development assets, that's a very significant mm-hmm. presence in the context of Africa.
Is there a country in Africa where there seems to be progress on this issue?
Well, it's difficult because I think, you know, the areas of progress are where you have an invested partner. You know, there have been times where there's been progress in Somalia, where Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group, has occupied large stretches of territory. What the progress there has been down to U.S. and European Union support and training for African peacekeeping troops to go in and do the fighting and keep the peace. And they've made some progress there, although there have been very significant reversals lately. Similarly, if you go across to Nigeria, there's been a Boko Haram, this group having an insurgency there, which has now been sort of internationalized as it's hooked up with Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. There's been some progress there in sort of beating back the insurgency. And again, it's largely down to efforts to get the regional militaries in the neighborhood to sort of take the fight to Boko Haram.
Let me quote something that Senator Lindsey Graham said last week, and this is quoting, "The war is morphing. You're going to see more actions in Africa, not less. You're going to see more aggression by the United States towards our enemies, not less. You're going to have decisions being made not in the White House, but out in the field." How do you interpret what he said?
Those comments alarmed me. They struck me as a mission creep. What are we actually doing in these countries? It's fine to be doing training and trying to professionalize troops. But if you suddenly are taking the fight to some of these groups, which let's face it, do not present a threat to national security, at least homeland security here in the United States, then there's reasons to be concerned here. There's always a risk where it's important to remember that a lot of these groups are rooted in domestic grievances. And only latterly have they, for reasons of opportunism and perhaps funding, align themselves with either IS or Al-Qaeda. There's always a risk that the U.S., by inserting themselves into these disputes and these insurgencies, sort of internationalizes and blows up these conflicts into something that they weren't originally.
We're almost out of timer, so what should we be doing if not this?
I think there just needs to be a lot more caution in how we get involved and what we do. And most importantly of all, you cannot have a policy towards Africa which is driven by security concerns. You have to have diplomats on the ground. You have to have development workers on the ground. You cannot the face of the United States in Africa cannot be a soldier. It has to be a someone else.
Well, Richard Downey, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Joining us by Skype, he is Deputy Director of the Africa Program for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And after this very short break, we'll be talking with Larry Krasner. He wants to be District Attorney of Philadelphia. He's the Democrat. I should say yesterday, Beth Grossman, the Republican candidate, was our guest. Much to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Larry Krasner has been a civil rights attorney in Philadelphia for three decades and has defended representatives of Black Lives Matter, Occupy Philadelphia, and ACT UP. And he sued the Philadelphia Police Department some 75 times. He has never prosecuted a case. Now, this is not the typical resume of someone who wants to be district attorney of Philadelphia or any city for that matter, but these are not normal times. Krasner defeated his Democratic rivals in the spring primary, and he now faces Republican Beth Grossman in the general election, which is 2 weeks from today. He says the win-at-any-cost culture of the district attorney's office has to change. He opposes the death penalty, stop-and-frisk, cash bail, and civil asset forfeiture. If elected, he says, the office will focus on serious crimes and reduce the number of people who are behind bars. Republican candidate Beth Grossman was our guest yesterday, and today it's Larry Krasner's term, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. If you win this race, what will be your speech to your prosecutors, or 300 of them in this city, about how you want to change the mission of the office and perhaps even their jobs?
Well, it's not written yet, but now's as good a time as any.
Go for it.
It will be a speech about transformational change, and it will be a speech about the direction the criminal justice system has been headed for a long time and the very, very serious problems that have gone with that. It will also be a speech that will remind them of their best selves. And there are a ton of great prosecutors in that office who I've known personally for 30 years, with whom I've tried dozens of cases in some instances. We need to bring out the best in them, and we need to bring out the best in that culture, and we need to change quite a few things.
There's something that you said to The Intercept. If we have a truly progressive DA, there's going to be a certain portion of the DA's office who can't stand the idea of change, and they're going to leave. That seems to be sending a message to at least some of these prosecutors that their days are numbered if you win this job.
I think that's a correct statement. It's also a statement that should come as no surprise. If you look, for example, at Josh Shapiro, who just became the attorney general in Pennsylvania, he...
You all right?
I'm fine. He ultimately had to part with 40-plus attorneys and over 60 people who were there. And that is in an office of an equivalent size. So, you know, that is, there's nothing new about that. Ed Rendell, when he came in as DA, as a 35-year-old, told every single person in the office to submit their resignation. If you look at other district attorney's offices around the country, for example, Kim Ogg, who came out of the victims' rights movement and became the district attorney in Houston, and with whom I've visited now twice, she dismissed over 40 people, again, in a similarly sized office. This is normal. It is routine. There's nothing special about it. And it's not that I in any way look forward to it, but the reality is you should not take a job and you should not take the taxpayers' money if you're not going to do it.
What does, though, a defense attorney bring to the job of essentially top prosecutor in the city of Philadelphia?
I think that, well, it depends on the defense attorney, frankly. But if you're asking what does my background bring to it,
right.
You know, the reality is I have more experience in criminal court than any of the candidates who have run in this race, and by far. I have tried thousands of cases. I have handled more than 10,000 cases. And I have been in court 4 to 5 days a week for 30 years, both in Philadelphia state and federal court, but also in other counties. And that means that on a daily basis, I've been dealing not only with these few hundred Philadelphia district attorneys, but I've been dealing with hundreds of district attorneys in other locations, working with them, sometimes working against them. That is experience. That is real experience. And it's also the kind of experience that prosecutors don't necessarily get. For example, they don't get to talk to people who are charged with crimes, or if they do, it's very, very uncommon. I've spoken to people charged with crimes tens of thousands of times. I've spent over a year in jail. I know the difference between people who are basically good people who have done something that is more situational, and people who, frankly, are a menace and profoundly evil. And we need to be more surgical in how we draw that distinction.
Picking up and perhaps asking the same question in a different kind of way, it seems the job of district attorney is essentially to keep the people who live and work in Philadelphia safe. Safe from criminals who want to do them harm, or perhaps even criminals that are do more nuisance crimes and nonetheless make life difficult. How do you want to address that?
The oath of a district attorney includes that. It is specifically an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws, and it is an oath to pursue justice. Obviously, the most important part of pursuing justice is to keep people safe. You know, I have been a victim of crime personally. Oh, yeah.
And what happened?
I was slashed in the head with a knife. I was actually attacked by a couple of people about 10 years ago and was fortunate that it didn't end up worse than it did.
Serious crime, though, right?
It's serious crime. And I have been around people. You know, I mean, everybody thinks that there are either victims or there are criminal defendants. Very, very often what you see is that someone who was a victim earlier becomes a criminal defendant later because there's no addressing the trauma. I've done death penalty cases where I found out that the defendant had been raped as a 12-year-old in an alley by a stranger. These things happen. So, you know, it's crucial that we address the reality that victims have their lives changed and the lives of their families changed forever by serious crime. We need to be sensitive to that and open to that. But at the same time, we have to look at what prevents crime. Mm. And if what you're doing, which is what we are doing, is spending all of your money on jail in an indiscriminate sort of blunt kind of way as opposed to much more surgically figuring out who belongs in jail and who doesn't, then you destroy your public schools and you destroy drug treatment and you destroy economic opportunity, which is the best way to prevent crime.
You've talked about and you're obviously indicating that you want to focus on the more serious crimes. I'm assuming crimes of violence, domestic violence, crimes involving firearms, things like that. Do you see that as a money saver, the idea that the city would spend less money on criminal justice, incarceration?
I guess it's a money saver in the sense that we're not lighting as much money on fire anymore. I mean, we have to remember where we are. We are the most incarcerated nation in the world, and we claim to be a land of freedom. Pennsylvania has 7 times as many people in jail as it did in the 70s as compared to the U.S., which is bad enough. They have 5 times. And Philadelphia is the most incarcerated city in the United States. You know,
also there are more people per population who are behind bars.
That is correct. It's getting better, thanks in part to the MacArthur Foundation grant and about an 18% reduction that has been coming. But this is a big deal. You know, people don't talk about this. My entire career of 30 years has been defined by watching jails open and schools close. And the consequences, frankly, in the poorest of the 10 largest cities, which in 2014 had the highest homicide rate, has a very low rate of solving those homicides, and a very high rate of incarceration. Mm-hmm. These are compelling consequences.
What, though, if you're district attorney, what specifically can you do about that?
About mass incarceration?
Yes.
So many things. We can start with the fact that the DA's office here has been rubber stamped to bring charges whenever they were presented by police. They bring about 97-98% of all cases that are presented by police, and that compares to other jurisdictions where you might only have 80 or 85% of these cases brought. You can look very early as to whether you even want to involve certain people in the system. Oakland, for example, and I have been there and I've visited with people who are expert in this, has a really excellent system involving juveniles that avoids the bringing of charges for the vast majority while holding them accountable and while getting a better approval rating from victims than is ordinarily obtained. You know, that is one way you do it. You divert cases out of the system. You also divert cases within the system. And then there's the whole issue of fairness as you move forward. We really don't need to be prosecuting people who are innocent. We really don't need to be wasting money on ridiculous prosecutions like prosecution for possession of marijuana, a drug that kills no one, while we're dealing with an opiate and opioid crisis that is killing astounding levels of people, 3 to 4 a day in Philadelphia.
Are you talking
alone.
About decriminalizing marijuana then?
Let's understand.
You wouldn't have the power to do that, right. But nonetheless, is that what you're... I
have absolutely no intention of prosecuting people for possession of marijuana.
Any amount? Well, I mean, the small amounts now get basically a slap on the wrist.
They do and they don't. I mean, it is true that it's a lot better than it used to be, but there are still about 600 cases a year that are prosecuted in the normal course because this DA's office has had a policy of prosecuting you when you buy $10 worth of marijuana on a street corner if they bust the dealer at the same time. I could get into it, but it's frankly kind of boring. That's 600 cases that are completely wasted resources that we shouldn't pursue. We know that where marijuana is generally available, you're seeing a 25% reduction in fatal overdoses from opiates, opioids, fentanyl, mm-hmm. and heroin. So why on earth then would we waste resources on something that in the middle of this big pharma-generated crisis saves lives?
That's Larry Krasner. He wants to be Philadelphia's new district attorney. He's the Democrat running against Republican candidate Beth Grossman, who was our guest yesterday. And you can join our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Andrew to join us, not calling us from Philadelphia, calling us from Pineville. Go ahead, Andrew.
Why, hello. We're opening a business in Philadelphia. The job is currently under construction, and we've been broken into, the job site has been broken into and robbed 6 times in the last 4 weeks, and that's with the neighbors keeping most of the ones out. But at any rate, last week I was subpoenaed to go to a pretrial hearing for this young man who has been in jail for about a month because of this, and there were 38 cases on the docket. 36 of them, I was there for 2 hours, 36 of them were related to heroin. And I was just wondering, watching all these public defenders and watching all these attorneys, and more so watching all these police officers, and there were hundreds of them in the building, having to come and testify to all these things, do you have any solution to how this waste of time and waste of young lives can be solved?
Andrew, thanks for the call. Larry Krasner, go ahead.
Andrew raises a great question, which, not only I think encapsulates a crisis where we find ourselves, but also talks about the inefficiency of how the courts address it. And yeah, we do have some solutions. The biggest solution is you got to start at the top. You have a 400% increase in the availability of the pills that cause the heroin and pill epidemic. And that is due to the fact that Big Pharma likes its money. It is also due to the fact that the federal government backed down under lobbying pressure on measures that made it more difficult to send 9 million pills to towns where there were only 300 residents, in other words, to diversion pharmacies. You have to do what we have not done. You have to start at the top. You have to apply pressure to Big Pharma. We need to screw down on the supply so it's back to the level it used to be at 10 years ago before it quadrupled. You have to be willing to go directly after people in the medical profession, and those are pain centers, and they are pharmacies, and they are doctors, and frankly, they are, you know, doctors and dentists at every level. You have to screw down on that first and foremost, because what is happening is because of the quadrupling of these pills, we have a quadrupling of addiction, and we have a quadrupling of fatal overdoses, almost down to the numbers. I mean, it's amazing, but that's the reality of it. And then, of course, you have to use more traditional measures as well.
He's talked about the fact that he's opening a business in Philadelphia. It's been broken into, I think he said, six times. What do you do about that? I mean, the fact that I think in some neighborhoods, while there are problems of gun violence and just plain old violence, that there are lots of nuisance crimes and breaking and entering and things that just make life difficult for the regular resident in Philadelphia. What can a district attorney do about that?
Well, you know, obviously the district attorney is not the police department. We do have the fourth largest police department in the United States. I think we have a good commissioner in Commissioner Ross, and I think we had a good commissioner in Commissioner Ramsey, both of whom I know reasonably well, and, you know, but with both of whom I've had a pretty good relationship. So primarily, that investigative duty is up to them. There's a lot of research that shows that the presence of police in proper ways deters crime much more than long sentences do, that the immediacy of the presence of police and the immediacy of the fear of detection is what actually deters crime. And I look forward to working with the commissioner to try to further that. But I think Andrew's question was specifically directed at the reality that he is suffering those crimes because of an epidemic that requires – I shouldn't say requires – that compels addicts to just keep stealing so that they can afford their habit.
You mentioned the police, and every introduction or every description of you, Larry Krasner, is that you have sued the Philadelphia Police Department 75 times. I don't know what your win-loss ratio is with all those suits, but do you see the police department or even the police as the problem? I ran across a quote where you talked about, I wasn't sure if it was the department in general, being systematically racist.
Well, do I see the police as the problem? No. I see some police as a problem in the same way I see some people who are not police as a problem. You know, the reality is that I did Section 1983 civil rights lawsuits against a small number of police officers over all those years because the district attorney's office abdicated its role to hold them accountable. I mean, the reality is the only prosecutors for the police in the last 30 years have been the civil rights attorneys in the city, including Dave Rudofsky and others, who have had to use the only remedy available in order to try to hold police accountable. And I'm proud of that work. You know, I think it is very important that no one is above the law, that if you're rich or you're poor or that you're famous, you're not famous, you have a uniform or you don't, you're political or you don't. I think it's important in a city that is dissatisfied with its own levels of corruption that everyone is treated in an even-handed way.
How corrupt do you think this city is?
It's corrupt.
How corrupt?
There's a whole lot of corrupt. I mean,
well, including Seth Williams, who faces a sentence today.
Well,
this job.
It is very disheartening, I think, for voters and for people who want to believe in a democratic process to see that so many of the people who have been elected have either been pushed out of office or they have been sent to jail or convicted of crimes. I think that's very, very disappointing. And then to find out that others are currently under investigation, it's disappointing. You know, public servants have a role, and that role is not to lie, cheat, and steal. And that role is not to turn whatever mission they're on as they run for office into, you know, an ego-oriented, self-aggrandizing and self-enriching mission.
How much do you think Seth Williams has made the job of the next district attorney more difficult?
Well, I think in some ways he's made it easier, to be honest, because that's pretty low bar. You know, I mean, everybody would like to talk about his individual corruption, and it's a very bad thing. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be taking $46,000 roofs that you somehow forget, and free sofas and free cars and free trips. You shouldn't be using the office as a place where you promote your cronies. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but there used to be, when he came into office, about 12 supervisors. By the time he was done, he was up to 59, which I think says a lot about how he was running things around there. But the real story here is not just about the failings. The failures of one person. The real story here is about a system that has misallocated resources so massively that we don't have a prevention model for crime, and that there is a perception of injustice because it is unjust for 1 in 3 black men to experience jail and 1 in 17 white men to experience it.
Is that because of what the prosecutors do, or just the way the laws are written about whether it's cocaine or, you know, crack cocaine or powder cocaine?
Well, I mean, the laws about sentencing of powder versus crack were written, frankly, from a place of racism. I'm not saying somebody sat in a corner and devised a racist outcome, but the outcome was without question racist. And there is a racist aspect to the system that's undeniable. It's a much broader issue, but if we even just look at how enforcement is done by police departments in the United States, we all know the reality. The reality is that if you're a kid on Penn campus walking around with weed in your back pocket, you are going to be protected by the Penn police. That's what they're there for. And if you are a black or brown kid who is 3 blocks away, who is not a Penn student, then you're going to be put up against a wall 3 or 4 times by police officers who, probably against their will, have been directed to engage in illegal stop and frisk. And so your chances of being brought into the criminal justice system are much higher simply because you're poor and probably brown and black.
And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking with Larry Krasner. He's been a defense attorney, a civil rights attorney here in Philadelphia for 3 decades, and he wants to be the city's next district attorney. The election is in 2 weeks, and you can join our conversation. Questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Larry Krasner is our guest. He wants to be Philadelphia's new district attorney. He's running as a Democrat. And I should add once again that his Republican candidate, Beth Grossman, was our guest yesterday. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I want to quote from a letter that came from some of the assistant district attorneys. It goes back a couple of months, goes back actually to May 12, 2017. They take issue with some of the things that you have said about the district attorney's office. They say the DA's office is not, as Mr. Krasner's website says, driven by a win-at-any-cost culture that prioritizes high conviction rates and harsh sentencing over more effective approaches that are proven to reduce crime. It goes on to say that the DA's office has literally given out awards to prosecutors for exonerating people. They also say that the district attorney's office employs some 300 prosecutors. They are public servants who represent every race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and come from every background. Women make up 2/3 of supervisory positions. Again, I guess picking up on what I said at the very beginning of the hour, are you going to meet some kind of revolt if you become the city's new district attorney?
You know, I think the short answer is no. We have been, look, you got to know, I'm sitting here with a cell phone that has dozens, scores of personal cell numbers for assistant district attorneys. And even though in that culture right now, they cannot come out, as it were, and say they're Krasner supporters, the reality is that a lot of them text me and they call me and they let me know what's going on in there. They're very supportive. I mean, there are people in that office who should be elevated to supervisory positions, and I mean immediately upon arriving in there. And there is also, I think, a feeling among the millennials that this is a very positive thing because they've had to live with a system in which there is undercompensation for really hardworking young attorneys, while various supervisors who, frankly, have no credible record of even trying cases are making 3 times the money for saying no to whatever it is that they need. So I think that what we're going to see is broad support among a lot of younger ADAs, but we are going to see that there are some people in there whose vision for a DA's office is so entrenched that they are unwilling to embrace a new one. they have, in fact, caused the problem, which got us where we are, and that they will be better served by being somewhere else.
Fire them, or you just will figure out how to move them out?
We will do what is necessary.
Whatever that – I mean, does a district attorney have the authority to fire people that have worked for 30 years?
The district attorney in Philadelphia has all employees at will.
Right.
In theory, one could walk in and fire everyone. I would have absolutely no interest in doing anything like that. But in theory, one could do that. That is what Ed Rendell effectively did. He walked in and said, give me all your resignation letters, and then he went from there.
You mentioned millennials. Do you see that? Is that your base?
It is one of our bases. I think in terms of this district attorney's office, though, it's very important to understand that the phrase mass incarceration was something I probably never even heard 10 years ago. And now you go to law schools, the same law schools where these new DAs come from, and they are teaching courses that are called mass incarceration or called criminal justice reform. They're reading articles about, you know, a handbook for the progressive prosecutor. There's a completely different culture in terms of the education of young prosecutors who are coming out of law schools as opposed to what we experienced 30 years ago when we came out of law school. So I expect to have very broad support among the vast majority of the young prosecutors who are in there. It's more of a generational issue as I see it.
Let me see what Alan from Philadelphia has to say. Alan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, the average case that goes through courts here takes two or more times and is handled by more than one prosecutor. The prosecutors don't seem to own the cases. My question is, how would you prevent unnecessary prosecution of cases where the evidence clearly does not support the accusation?
How will you prevent unnecessary prosecution of cases? Larry Krasner, go ahead.
Matt, is a great question from Alan, and frankly a multi-layered question, because he's not only talking about not prosecuting cases that are a waste of time, he's also talking about case management. For those of us who have tried cases in federal court, and I've tried hundreds, and who have been in other jurisdictions on a regular basis, and I've been in all the counties and even in other states on a regular basis, we know that there are other towns and there are other jurisdictions where cases move along much more efficiently. There's a lot of reasons for that. But, for example, when I started out as an attorney, you might go to court four or five times on a felony case to complete it, which is understandable in a very busy jurisdiction. Now you might go 20 times. You know, nothing's getting done by going to court 20 times. You have to have a system that's much more efficient. So in terms of not prosecuting cases that cannot be won and not wasting resources in that fashion, not prosecuting cases against innocent people, not prosecuting cases that are a waste of time, such as marijuana possession, that's a matter of discretion. That's a matter of a district attorney simply deciding not to do stupid anymore. Well, just so you know, Marty, I don't intend to do stupid anymore.
But how do you know stupid? Before you've tried it, how do you know that something is stupid or someone is innocent?
You know as much as you can know. This is an imperfect system, obviously. But one way that you know is by reading all of the discovery in the case. I mean, basically, that's what both sides do, defense and prosecution. They look through all the paperwork in the case. They talk to some witnesses. And there are some red flags for things that are wrong with these cases that you can pick up on. It's not the average case. The average case looks pretty good. But there are some red flags you can pick up on. You know, we've had a system in which the DAs were so political that they would try to force the judges to make the decisions the DA should have made. They would have the judges acquit, the judges throw the case out, the judges say you have insufficient evidence, rather than owning that and doing it themselves so that they could blame the judges and the press. And there's a very long pattern of that. We need to be responsible for our decisions, make appropriate decisions, dump cases that need to be dumped, and we also need to then address case management. There are considerable savings in a system where you stop wasting time.
You've said that you would not bring cases that involved illegal searches by the police.
That is not only would I not do that, that is the sworn obligation of every prosecutor in the United States to uphold the Constitution of the United States. No prosecutor should ever have been proceeding on a case where they know that there is a constitutional violation.
Alan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Here's a tweet that says, is it true or fake news that you accepted $1.45 million from George Soros to fund a PAC that was backing you? This would have been during the primary.
So it is fake news that I accepted $1.45 million. It's also fake news that I accepted $1. I'm going to repeat that. It is fake news that my campaign accepted $1 from a PAC backed by George Soros. It is a true fact that George Soros chose to use PAC money, or his PAC chose to use that money to buy television, newspaper, and radio ads on their own. But the way that works under the law is I can have absolutely no contact with them, no participation. If they use any video, they have to sneak up and take it when I don't know what's happening. And in fact, when it started, I did not even know it was going to start. That's the truth. And it has been misrepresented repeatedly as if somehow I'm in a room with Soros. I've never met Soros. He's never met me. That's the reality of what is happening now since Citizens United. Corporations and large PACs can spend money as they choose. And if Soros had chosen to make ads saying I was a vampire, he could have done that. Mm. Or that I like to eat kittens. He could have done that. But instead, I think because he, like me, is interested in criminal justice reform, he gave favorable ads.
Let me quote something that Charles Ellison wrote in the Philadelphia Citizen. He's a broadcaster at WURD. He said, Democrats, including Krasner, utterly failed during their primary to answer a key question from the block of city voters who pay attention to the DA race. How are you going to keep me safe, my neighborhood, and my family? And he also seemed to be saying or said I'm looking here. Sorry. we've gotten that for the majority of people living in the city, yes, crime is an important issue. People obviously want to be safe from crime. But there's so many larger issues at stake here having to do with just nuisance and quality of life.
Well, I guess I respectfully disagree with Mr. Ellison. I appreciate his input, as I appreciate all free speech and I appreciate all journalists. But I have been very, very clear that the science shows that 6% of criminals commit 60% of the crime, and that you have to move away from our reactive law enforcement system towards an intelligence-based, meaning I'm not making judgment about IQ. I'm saying intelligence, information coming into a police department so that there is proactive moving in the direction of the gun before it fires. I've been clear about that. And that is not just my viewpoint. This is based on extensive readings and a whole lot of research on some very respected criminologists, including ones who consult with the Philadelphia Police Department. Once you recognize that 6% of criminals commit 60% of the crime, you go after them. You focus upon them. Now, that is a short-term approach, but there is a much longer-term approach, which is we look at the bigger science, the reality that prevention works. It works in medicine. It works in criminal justice. We just have never done it. And so you have to start taking these resources that are frankly being lit on fire to mass incarcerate members of that other 90%, 94% who don't commit all this crime. You got to put that money back in your public schools, like it was for me when I came out of public school. You got to put that money into drug treatment instead of incarceration of people who suffer the medical condition of addiction. You got to put it into economic development and job training. And if you do that, guess what? There's less crime. You know, I understand it's a longer term solution. It's not as press friendly. It's not Dirty Harry, but it works.
Mm. It almost sounds, and this is something actually that Charles Ellison said, it almost sounds like you're running for city council.
Heaven forbid.
No, you wouldn't want that?
I am not interested in anything in office other than being a district attorney. And I want to do that because I got 30 years of banging my head against the wall of that office and making it better in some ways. But I know that there's a lot more that needs to be done and the direction of the office has to be reversed.
Let me get Danielle from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. We want some folks from Philadelphia to call us. Danielle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, I have a question. Wanted to hear your thoughts on child sex offenders and recidivism rates. I know that there's been a big study in 2005 and one this year in the UK that shows that they really cannot be rehabilitated, the great majority of them. Do you, what's your thoughts on sort of making exceptions for certain kinds of offenders, including child sex offenders, in this kind of rehabilitation approach, which has shown not to work for those kinds of offenders?
And Danielle, let me just jump in here only because we have someone from the Joseph J. Peters Institute on Philadelphia in the last week or so, and they do deal with sex offenders, and I can't speak for them, but feel as if with the right kind of treatment, they can deal with this issue of recidivism. But go ahead, Larry Krasner.
Well, I appreciate the question from Danielle. It's a pretty broad question and frankly not necessarily specific to what we're talking about. For example, if you look at individuals who are caught with child pornography, which is obviously an incredibly serious offense and one that preoccupies many of us, the results are actually quite different than what you say. They show approximately a rate of recidivism of any type that's on the order of 5%, according to some studies. And in terms of touching offenses, which are obviously a much greater concern to all of us, you're looking at more like a 3% rate based on some of these studies. So, look, we have to be open to reading all the studies. The studies you're referring to, I would love to see. I'd love to take a look at that. And I think we all realize that perhaps it's not quite as heinous as homicide, but boy, it's close. Sexual offenses against children are at the absolute top of the most offensive list and in many ways the most culpable and the most worthy of severe punishment. But, you know, some broad brush saying nobody can ever be rehabilitated is not the approach we're going to use. We're going to be surgical and careful, and we're going to separate the people who are real bad from the ones who are redeemable.
We have Mike from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious, what are the legal barriers to supervised injection facilities being opened in Philadelphia?
The legal injection sites?
That's correct.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call.
Great question, Mike. So, what are the legal barriers? Well, the biggest barrier you have is Donald Trump, who is the head of my opponent's party. That would be the Republican Party. Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions are very excitedly carrying on about starting the war on drugs over again because it was such a good idea. We need to repeat that, right? And so I think the reality is that they're looking to go after states where they are distributing medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, and they're probably also going to get all excited about the possibility of harm reduction because heaven forbid we would have any of that. It's much better to have all kinds of people dying of overdoses. So the biggest problem I really don't think is legal, because prosecutors at every level have the discretion to be intelligent about when and how to charge people with offenses. The biggest problem is political, and it comes down to Sessions and it comes down to Trump. In terms of the specific laws, it is possible to go after people under state law, and you know the district attorney of Philadelphia does not enforce federal law. They only enforce state law.
Correct.
So it is possible to go after people who are walking into a harm reduction center who have drugs and charge them with possession of drugs. It's possible to charge them with possession of drug paraphernalia because they have needles to inject, things of that sort. And this is the kind of thing that was threatened many years ago by Ernie Priate when I was representing Prevention Point, when he was talking about how he was going to charge them with these things. As it turned out, he didn't. He went to jail for bribery, which is no big surprise because that's what usually happens to tough-talking people who don't want to save lives.
Hmm. So that's a broad statement.
Well, I mean, you know, the reality is that you had a situation where they could have been hyper-technical and going after good people, idealistic doctors trying to save lives. And what they would have done was to spread more HIV, AIDS, and Hep C. They failed. I'm glad they failed. And it's important that we have prosecutors who are not just going to be going lockstep with methodologies that are harmful.
Let me ask you just a political question as we end the hour. In the primary the spring, only 17% of voters went to the polls. You got 35% of that 17%. Why such low interest in such an important race and such an important position? And are you worried about turnout, especially since you seem to be relying on millennials and young people that probably don't have the kind of track record that older voters have?
Here I have to respectfully differ with you. What actually happened in this primary was a miraculous explosion of votes. 8 years ago in a similar cycle where there was a contested DA's primary, there's a very low turnout. Primaries.
Lower than 17?
8 years ago, there were only 100,000 total votes, and this year there were 150,000 total votes. The Democratic Party was both excited and agitated, and so were the Republicans, because as you may recall, Trump won the state by 45,000. So we actually had, I would love to see 90% participation, but in terms of the history of voting, this was an explosion of additional votes, and our finish in the primary was more votes than the next two people combined.
Larry Krasner, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And he is running for District Attorney of Philadelphia. And again, yesterday our guest was Beth Grossman, the Republican candidate. I should add Larry Krasner is a Democrat. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.